Radio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are a go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on here.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment we're going to be speaking to Paul Blow from Quebec City. Bonjour, comment ça va?
Ça va très bien, Len, toi?
Oh, pas mal. Okay, boy. So we were saying hello in French. So good evening, everyone. Paul, you just came back from the Dallas conference, and we're going to be speaking about presentations that went on with you and Andrew Eiler and Jeff. But before we get to that, I thought maybe just me and you could give me an overview, a relatively short briefing of your impressions of what went on at the conference for people who weren't there. And then we'll have the other guys join us for an in-depth discussion of your presentation.
Okay, I'd be happy to, Len. So, yeah, I just came back last night, very late, actually, from Dallas. I spent Thursday evening last week all the way till Monday morning this week. And I went through 3 days of conference activity and other stuff. I didn't just stick to the conferences because some of the subjects that were covered I was more familiar with, and I had so many things going on at the same time because I was being interviewed about our book, Chokeholds, by radio stations. I'll start off with one incredible activity that we did, and it's with one of the experts, I think, on the whole Tippit assassination. You know Matt Douthit, who is a Texan. He's from Dallas. And we met another fellow there called Rick DeLaughter. He was not a researcher, but who follows and comes to these meetings often. And he came to our table and bought a few books, and we started chatting it up, and we just hit it off. And he offered to give lifts to some of the interested parties. On Sunday morning, we went to do Oswald's escape, you know, his so-called escape using public transit from the Texas School Book Depository, and then his ride over to his rooming house, and then the assassination scene, which culminated with him being arrested in the Texas theater. And what's wonderful with that presentation is, when you do it, you see just how much of a timing problem you have between him leaving the Texas School Book Depository past 12:30, getting to his rooming house, look, an Olympian couldn't do what the Warren Commission claims he did. And there's so much controversy because we actually walked many of the distance he was supposed to have walked, and it's just not feasible, you know, and they have to, you know, because they have Oswald going directly, taking a more direct route from his rooming house to the scene on Patton and 10th Street where Tippit gets assassinated. But as Matt presented, told us, is that the problem with that is there are so many witnesses that saw him coming from the opposite side. In other words, he had to go around a huge block to be able to arrive from where he was arriving, according to the witnesses that saw a character. Many of them did not even identify Oswald or would not. And even Helen Markham, her identification, she's a key witness in that, was terrible. But nevertheless, that exercise, and Matt knows exactly where the shells were found, what he's able to tell you witness by witness, what they claim to have seen, where there are similarities, where there are contradictions. He can talk about the shells. He even has a little pitch book, a little story book that he pulls out. He even has replicas of the shells that were found. And look, there are so many problems there in terms of witness testimony, in terms of timing testimony, in terms of ballistics. And, you know, for somebody to call that the Rosetta Stone for the Warren Commission or for proving Oswald's guilt, it's the opposite. Okay, it's not even a bowl of jello when you look at that. But that was a highlight. And, you know, we did it. Then Rick drove, and he showed me for the first time Jack Ruby's apartment. And you can see that it's sort of in a line with between, you know, the activity around the Texas school book, the Texas theater and the rooming house. It's all lined up, you know, and these are amazing scenes. Then we went to the backyard photo scene on Neely Street. So the walls are falling apart. The building, I mean, it's full of wasps. The wood is rotten. I'm telling you, if you want to see these historic places, I'm not sure how many of them will be standing in the near future, but you better be hurry, because I had taken a picture of myself near that famous staircase 2 years ago. We had to squeeze in between a wall, a wooden wall, a picket fence, and the backyard, and it was abandoned. And now that picket fence is mostly knocked down. So, but look, it's an amazing thing that we did, and that is worth its the trip in. And Matt is amazing in terms of his knowledge around that. So that's one highlight. The second highlight were some of the presentations. I wasn't able to attend them all, but I saw Brian Edwards' presentation about his book called Admitted Assassin. And it's on the Roscoe White story. And I'm almost finished reading the book. I decided I'm going to read this book because I know Ricky White, the first time, Roscoe's son, when he presented all the information around that, was discredited. But when you reread the book, I have to say this, there's an awful lot of primary evidence presented in the book that forces you to think. Things that are in there that you're saying, boy, if that's not authentic, damn it, it must have been hard to come up with, you know, or to fake or forge. I don't want to pronounce myself on this until I finish reading the book, but it was interesting. Matt did something that he repeated when he gave us that tour, but he did something called the minimal facts approach to the Tippett murder. And basically he says, look, if the shells don't correspond to his gun, and if the bullets don't correspond to the shells, case closed. You can't find Oswald guilty. Then he says, if you have witnesses, and he quotes witness who said this, he'd be off the hook. So he goes with the witness testimony. The third testimony, a part that he shows, is he timed every sequence of his escape, his supposed escape, the bus ride, the taxi cab ride, the walking. I mean, you know, think of this. The taxi cab drops him six blocks beyond his house. What's going on there? Six blocks. And then he has to walk that distance. Well, we did that walking. And the timing doesn't work. So anyway, he calls it the minimal facts. And he says, look, if you accept these facts as I'm going to present them, even one of them, forget it. You can't find him guilty of that assassination. Really interesting. Janet Grodin talked about the Tippett witnesses' point of view. So she took Helen Markham and she pointed out things that she said in her testimony that indicated that she couldn't have been on the point the Warren Commission puts her to see it. Because, for instance, she says she saw things in a small road, between two houses, and there's no way you could see what she saw between the two houses if she was on the street corner where she claims to have been. So There's a real sense that she was pressured into giving the testimony that she did that incriminated Oswald. On Saturday, Dick Russell got my attention, and there were other very good speakers, but you know, I wasn't able to listen to them all because I had to do interviews myself. And then the final day, I heard Robert Groden. And every time Robert Groden talks about the Zapruder film and his opinion of it, you know you're talking to an authority. He has such an incredible delivery and such an experience around all the photographic expertise and analysis that he did. You know, he actually did for the HSCA. So that was, I mean, it's supremely interesting. And you're going to hear from myself a little later and Andrew Eiler and Jeff Crudell, because something really incredible happened during the banquet on Saturday. You know, there were solemn moments where we were underscoring some of the heroes of the past, including Cyril Weck, where people, you know, people had some nice stories to say about him, and people took the microphone, and David Lifton and others were, you know, underlined for the breakthroughs they came up with. But here's the thing is, because of findings you'll hear a bit about later at that, because I had gone to the archives before in Washington with Andrew Eiler, we made some really interesting discoveries. Well, they gave us the podium during the banquet after most, you know, when people were landed at dessert to talk about our findings. And I would say that that was one of the most interesting aspects of the presentation. Or the presentations. It was live, it was topical, it was timely, and it was refreshingly new. And again, I think got a lot of applause. I'll talk a little bit about my presentations, because other than during the banquet, I had two time slots given to me. One, the first one was on the Saturday. I presented with Jeff Meek and Dave Boylan. And we've talked about this on your show, Len, but we were explaining, you see, an awful lot of the topics, right, are, you know, when you get into Kilgallen or Nagel, or they're supremely interesting stories. But what I think was different with our first presentation about our research is one of the messages is, okay, how do we analyze all of this in terms of figuring out what happened? Okay, and that's the basis of the research we're doing, is we're trying to find out from the leading researchers, people who are well-read, who've gone to conferences, we're doing it through surveys, we're doing it through personal interviews. We've interviewed people on your show, people like Larry Hancock, Jim DiEugenio, Jeff Morley, Johnny Cairns, John Newman, and Greg Burnham. And we've also looked at what people, you know, have written in the past, people like Fletcher Prouty, what we call insiders, right? We're looking at what Dan Hardway said on the record about the nature of the crime. This is it, Len, is what I want to do now going forth is focus on the nature of the crime. What happened? Dave Boylan, it's an amazing amount of documentary researcher. And Jeff Meek is, he's just an incredible interviewer. So in terms of gathering information, I think we have a good team there. Now, when the audience looked at the research results and the survey results, and then we took highlights of the interview. So we just gave samples of our research for now because we're not done. And people were seeing that, you know what? There's a consensus, Len. The consensus among the research community was that this was a coup d'etat. It was a regime change perpetrated by regime change specialists, okay? Done using techniques such as Operation Northwoods and techniques used in regime changes abroad. and that by January 1963, there was no later than that, there was a major consensus that he had to go. If I were to say, tell you in a nutshell, that that's what we were talking about and presenting and saying, not this is in our opinion, if you're looking at a consensus of the research community, well, people found that uplifting. Now, what Dave and I and Jeff, to a certain degree, also did in one area is we presented an org chart, Glenn, of what the whole universe of intelligence looked like back in 1963. Let me repeat that. You know, I can say in a book, David Attlee Phillips was in Mexico City, and then I can say William Harvey did this, and then I can say, Jesus Angleton, he was known for doing that. But until you're able to place them in an org chart and say, well, where did they work in the CIA? What was the reporting? You know, what was the hierarchy there? What were the special groups, like the special groups that Lansdale was on, you know, that Fletcher Prouty often talked about? So what Dave Boylan was able to do is put all these names in an org chart, which is a work in progress. And it goes, so when you start understanding what the directorate of operations is, and you understand that they're the ones that do clandestine things such as assassination and regime changes, and that they're overseeing JM Wave, which is overseeing the Cuban exile community and the relationships with mafiosi, You can better understand the lines of communications and the persons of interest, the usual suspects that are involved or likely involved in this. So when someone like Dan Hardway says, I'd be really surprised that if the CIA, if there was a coup, I'd be really surprised if Harvey wasn't involved. Okay, well, why Harvey? Where was he? What? Where can you place that person in 1963? And then you take the names in the org chart and you can hyperlink from the names in the org chart, Lynn, to their profile. So, in other words, if you have that information on your laptop as you're reading a book, you say, okay, wait, Fitzgerald, where does he fit in again? You press that, you go on the org chart, you'll see where. So that, then the next thing we did there is we started looking at some 20 regime changes, Len, and special ops. We looked at the Guevara assassination. We looked at the Letelier assassination. We looked at Chile. We looked at Iran-Contra. We looked at Gladio. And we tried to get information. And when you see, Len, that Westbrook, okay, he's involved in intelligence and ends up in Vietnam, and you see that a guy like Jenkins is involved in Iran-Contra, just like Rodriguez, and you see that a guy like David Attlee Phillips is involved in Guatemala, Chile, you can understand that these people who know how to compartmentalize and carry out that type of thing abroad are the first people you look into when you want to know what's going on, what happened in this internal coup, because that's how the people see it. So that I think is part of the message, is how many times do we need to prove that Kennedy was shot from the front? As far as I'm concerned, we don't need to do it anymore. It's a fact. It is a fact. Okay, let's let it go now, and let's take these incredible brains that we have. I'm not saying to let it go. We still have to stay up, but let's harness our thinking power on saying, okay, the people who organized prior plots to kill Kennedy, are they the same people? And how can we work that way up? The people who organized regime changes abroad, the people who killed RFK, right? Are we seeing the same vectors? Are we seeing the same puppeteers? So that's where I think we're going to start making breakthroughs. So that was really well received. We were given an hour and a half for that presentation, and you could tell that there was tangible interest and people wanted to get the org chart. They wanted to, and we're going to make stuff more and more available for people as we, you know, we tighten up the information. So that tells you a little bit what happened there on that Saturday.
Yeah, that's good, because I think that there's two sets of researchers. One, people are watching every detail in Dealey Plaza, and another, people are not focused on Dealey Plaza so much, but just the overall picture. Like, who has, like, the power to cover it up? Where does the financing come from? Like, who's got the money to move this kind of stuff around? And then with that money has the influence to, you know, impose a Blue Ribbon Commission instead of a trial in Texas, right? So.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's where I want to be at. And that's where, you know, my research in primary documents is bringing me. So if you understand the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, if you understand that Oswald was given escorts, if you understand that there were prior plots leading up to the assassination, you know, if you understand how the Cuban exiles are organized, you know, people like Larry Hancock, Bill Simpich, Dave Boylan, John Newman, Jim DiGenio, you know, they have their eyes on the prize all the time, right? And they're you know, figuring out cryptonyms and things like that. So I agree with you in that sense, and that's where my real interest is, because I think too many of us get. And that was one of the focuses of my second presentation, because I was asked to present more information about our book, The JFK Assassination Chokeholds. And I decided, Len, to focus on our first chapter. And I had a reason for that. The first chapter in Chokeholds is really, what is the official record? As you know, history books will refer to the Warren Commission, and they'll say, well, based on the Warren Commission, Oswald the lone nut killed JFK, and there was no conspiracy, and that's their sole source. And that was the topic of my first presentation ever on your show, was that research I did on history books. And, you know, when I interviewed the writers of these books, not one of them was aware, or very few were aware, that there were five subsequent investigations, and that an investigation like the Church Committee or the HSCA came up with blistering statements completely impeaching the Warren Commission, which is their number one source. So that was the topic. So what I tried to do, Len, in that presentation was to turn the tables on the lone nut apologists, sir, okay, because, and to make people understand that, in fact, when you read the reports and when you listen to people like senators like Richard Schweiker or Russell or Boggs or Cooper, or the heads of some of the inquiries like Blakey and Sprague and Horn. When I say the heads, I mean very top people. Tannenbaum. When you listen to even people who are more doctors like McClellan or Crenshaw, or when you listen to even FBI people like Seibert and O'Neill, you know, the official record, in other words, these top insiders and what the reports themselves say, completely vindicate Garrison, completely crush the Warren Commission, completely crush the idea that even of the single bullet theory. Okay, so what I did there is I said, guys, let's put all these, I'm going to give you some 25 quotes here, rapid fire. Let's listen to them. Let's listen. So, you know, I have one with Schweiker, and I'm going to go on memory here. The Warren Commission has, in fact, collapse like a house of cards, and I believe was set up to feed pablum to the American people. My God, how can you ever quote the Warren Commission in your life when a senator, head of the committee that was to look into that aspect of the Church Committee, which was how the intelligence agencies performed their duties. That's just one. Then I love the one about, look, even the HSCA. The HSCA, this one, I think I'll find it because it's look, I'll read this. It's, oh, well, let's take this one, Hoover, right? In other words, it appears that there is a second person who was at the Soviet embassy down there. He's talking about the person that they caught on tape, which wasn't Oswald's voice, but playing himself off as Oswald. That's from Hoover talking to Johnson. What more do you need, right? Another one that made its way in there, right? The HSCA, this is what they said about David Ferry, Shaw, and Oswald. The committee believed the Clinton witnesses to be telling the truth as they knew it. It was therefore inclined to believe that Oswald was in Clinton, Louisiana in late August, early September 1963, and he was in the company of David Ferry, if not Clay Shaw. The committee was puzzled by Oswald's apparent association with Ferry, a person whose anti-Castro sentiments were so distant from those of Oswald, the Fair Play for Cuba committee campaigner. Now, anybody who attacks Garrison without at least revealing what the HSCA had to say about David Ferry, right, and the 544 Camp Street address, and other things that are just as blistering, isn't being honest. They're not being honest. When you read that, don't come and tell me the movie JFK is a pile of baloney, right? The HSCA comes in. And you know, Tannenbaum even said, hey, you know what? Robert Tannenbaum, who was one of the top people right at the HSCA when it started, he said he thought at first that Garrison was a bit of a, you know, a funny character because of a lot of the reports he had read. But the more he saw of what was coming out of Helms's office, the more he realized that what Garrison said was true, that they were harassing and intimidating his witnesses. Talk about vindication there, right? So when we went through that, I don't want to mention any lone nut apologists on your show, but who is more of an authority, Len? Is it any of these people, or is it Schweiker, Tannenbaum, Blakey, what's written in the reports? I didn't put one quote that I made in there. And, you know, they'll try and say, oh, it's taken out of context. Look, it's in black and white. If you go in our book and you follow the hyperlinks, you'll be able to hear with your own ears what the context was and what they said. So the point, and this is, I'm going to quote from my last slide here, and, you know, maybe if you have any questions, this is something else. Lewis Stokes, who was the chairman for the HSCA, he clearly says that our conclusion that there was a probable conspiracy was not based only on acoustical evidence, okay? So those who say, the HSCA came up with these conclusions because of acoustical evidence. No, that's from Lewis Stokes, the HSCA committee chairman, okay? So, you know, that would be disingenuous if you said that. So what I try, you know, like what I try to get in terms of a feeling, and I call it a paradigm shift. Who are the contrarians? It's not us. It's the lone nut theorists. Okay? The Warren Commission has been impeached. The official records are way more on our side and are way more in line with a conspiracy, right? And the other point is, I tried to make the example, Len, you know how Hemming and Jerry Patrick Hemming and Frank Sturgis just had Garrison chasing after his own tail? And they were put in there with a bunch of other people as disinformation artists? Well, I tried to tell the audience to beware of these type of people, okay? Because since it has been concluded that there is a conspiracy. Any podium you give to people who are, you know, like, you can have questions maybe, but who are, you know, still pushing that, hey, beyond a shadow of a doubt, Oswald acted alone. You can only think that way, Len, if you're you're a disinformation artist. You can only think that way. There's no way you can read a book like Chokeholds and some of the other book and say, well, I don't have doubts, you know? I mean, most people read these books, and the good ones will say, well, it's clear that there's a conspiracy. In just chapter one, it involves that. And that's why I say that these are the people that force, you know, make people, other people compelled to spend too much time interviewing them and hearing them out, answering their questions. Yeah, normally I don't mind hearing out an opposite point of view, but only if I think it's genuine. And I don't think that you can genuinely hold an opinion that conspiracy theorists are paranoid, that we're this or that. If you, at this point in time, don't think that there's at least a good chance of a conspiracy, I don't think either you're not well-read or you have an agenda. So that's what I concluded. And I was the last presenter. And I came up right after, I mean, the last one physically there, but right after Robert Grodin. And I said, oh, boy, you know, people are going to be tired. They're going to be thinking of wanting to head home. Some have probably some flights and this and that. No, there was a lot of interest, and I think they found that uplifting. It's as if, you know, many, many decades have gone by, and the Mark Lanes and the Cyril Wex and the Fletcher Proudies that took it on the chin, and, you know, the dirty things were done with these people, threats, getting the IRS after Cyril Wex, for instance, and all that. Well, you know, they paved the way for us, and I think I was trying to end on is, look, you know, because of the internet, because of shows like yours, because of documentaries like the ones Oliver Stone did, and because of some of the books we're writing, the tide is turning, and you know, it's no longer. I think if you're, it's risky if you're mainstream media and you go out there and you tell people, oh, no, Oswald alone did it, they'll be worried about losing their credibility more and more there. And if they're not, well, they better wake up and smell the coffee. So that, in a nutshell, is what I can tell you about Lancer. I don't know if you have any questions. Let me say something, though. Attendance this year went down. Last year, there was a couple of hundred people in the room all the time. Here, you know, you could count 60, 70.
Tell you why that was. That was because of one of the ridiculous speakers that they had put on there. And, you know, just I heard many people emailing me saying, are you kidding me? You know?
Yeah.
And so wave your flag around somebody like that, right? Like, you know, John McAdams featured, you know?
Yeah. I'll say this also is I think, you know what? We could, you were at the Quebec City event. If there was a bit of marketing and star power and things that we could do where we could maybe get a university and history students and open it up to a wider, I wouldn't be surprised. You could do something. I'm not saying Cap or Lance or whatever, but it's something we're done in New Orleans, for instance. And, you know, they could, you'd have, a Rob Reiner or, you know, an Oliver Stone or whatever. That could interest, the tourism industry in certain places, and it could interest sponsors. I mean, when you came to Quebec City, I'll remind you that we raised $130,000 from the city to fly people in and to get specialists involved. And it was right after COVID. You know?
Well, most of that budget was for me.
Oh yeah, yes, that's that. We wanted to roll out the red carpet. And, of course, your lovely spouse.
Okay, well, thank goodness that the local people there benefited from going to attend Oliver Stone and yourself and Jim DiEugenio giving all the talks that they gave. So that was great. And, you know, Oliver you know, being a part of a film festival as well. They played other films as well. But It was a win-win. It was a win-win. And I know what you're saying. They could do it somewhere else. You know, I'd be interested in another city. You know, maybe even Los Angeles. I'm not sure. But maybe even not even in America. I had planned one, I think, 2010 in Hawaii, where I thought, well, I'll have somewhere where people can go on vacation. And then in the evenings, there'll be these lectures. And then during the daytime, you're on a holiday.
That could be fun.
Yeah, yeah. It's where I met John Armstrong and, a couple people there that came from out of all over the place. But anyway, that's old news. Well, I'm glad you went. I'm glad you gave me a report. I'm just glad for any success, how little it is in people doing good research. And if you're doing good research, you can agree or disagree. And I'm sure I'll have John Armstrong on again. And there's some people that strongly disagree with him. And other people say, listen, look at what he's found. You know, look at some of the things he's discovered. And that doesn't mean you have to subscribe to everything. So as these different researchers write papers and write books, and then maybe, you know, in your chokehold book, one chapter, somebody doesn't subscribe to everything. But look at all the other chapters, right? So.
Oh, yeah. That's what I believe. And, you know, I really pleased with how things have turned out there in the last few years with the movie, the documentary by Oliver Stone, and some of the good work that's been coming out. And it's amazing how there's some good momentum there going. And again, thank you, Len, for having me on. And anytime you want to have me to discuss anything, it'll be a pleasure.
Okay, very good then. In the meantime, I'm going to get your other two compadres on the line and we'll go further with that.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. We're going to be speaking to Paul Blow, Jeff Crudell, and Andrew Eiler. And I think we have all three on the line. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Len.
Okay, good. Scared me for a minute. All right, you guys have just come back from the 2024 lecture series in Dallas. And I wanted to ask you about that. And also, you had a presentation, which is a lot of information that people that didn't get there and people that are listening to Black Op Radio are very interested in. So if one of you want to give an introduction to what your presentation was, and that, I'll just leave the floor open.
Sure. I think Jeff will start us off with giving just a little bit of a background. Before heading to Dallas, we went to the National Archives at College Park, Maryland. And so I'll just hand it over to Jeff and he can kind of set us up.
Sure. Well, to be honest with you, Andrew is the star of this show. When it comes to talking about the issue of final determination orders related to the documents. But let me take a step back because maybe it goes without saying, but I think the foremost issue on most Americans' minds about the assassination case, whether you know little or a lot about the JFK assassination, is when are they going to release the rest of the records? It's some 61 years past the assassination date, and there's just a sort of a befuddlement, a real bewilderment in the not only people in our country but all over the world who followed this case. Why can't the government release the remaining records so that we can see what's left? And it obviously calls into serious question when they can't. And that's really sort of the foundational issue that we're here to talk with you about tonight. And as you know, there's been litigation, and Andrew it can talk through that. It's been first and foremost as the issue has come to pass. Obviously, everyone thought those records would be released at the original release date, and there's been significant postponements beyond that, and that resulted in litigation which actually there was some news on that today, and I'll let, obviously Andrew is going to talk through that. But what came out of a lot of this and Andrew's involvement in some of the original research around this case is that, and it's startling, really, we're talking about trying to get the government to do something that they've already actually agreed to do. The final determination of each and every record that's in the JFK Records Act collection went through a process right before they closed shop at the end of the 1990s. And every one of those records has a final determination associated with it that has with some specificity, the instructions to release it and on a particular date, or if not to release it, to review it under certain circumstances and criteria at a later date. And we accompanied Andrew to the National Archives earlier in the week in a trek to track down some of those documents, which are not talked about very often and are so critical and important in the context of understanding legally whether or not the government has actually met its commitment. And so both Paul and I, again, accompanied Andrew on the trek to the National Archives earlier this week before we went on to the conferences. And what Andrew found, I'm gonna pause there because I think Andrew wants to tell you the story and give you more of the legal background and aspect of this. But what we found was pretty extraordinary. Our visit was, I think, to say the least, quite fruitful. So with that, I'll pause because I think, you know, Andrew, you probably want to tell the story of what happened when we got there.
Okay, I'm all ears.
Okay, yeah, so I'll very, very briefly, Len, talk a little bit of the law. So in 1992, I think most of your listeners know that the film JFK by Oliver Stone attracted an enormous amount of attention. And as a result of the final screen in that movie where it said that there were thousands of records still being withheld from the public, held in secret until 2029. That was back in 1992. The American public was outraged that so many records were being kept secret about a really profound event in American history. And people called their congressmen and women, they called their senators, and they demanded that something be done. And Congress very quickly and unanimously passed the JFK Records Act in 1992. The key section that I've been looking at over the last few years is section 9C3B. Now, what that section does, and I'll just paraphrase it, I don't want to put your listeners to sleep, that imposes a ministerial duty on the ARRB, the Assassination Records Review Board, to create a document that includes very specific information. It's got to include an identifier so that the specific assassination record can be identified. And then it's got to outline the postponements for each document. And some documents may have just one single postponement. That might be a word or a few words redacted, or it could have 15 to 20 postponements if it's a really long document. And those postponements could include several pages being redacted, or a paragraph being redacted, or just a bunch of words throughout the document being redacted. Each redaction in the document is called a postponement. So what these final determination forms out of Section 9C3B require the ARB to set a date where the disposition of that record whether it's through periodic review or it's the release of the file has to be specified in the ARRB final determination form. And I read that section of the Act and I'm going, oh, that's interesting. I really haven't seen any of these final determination forms in any of the records that I've looked at. I did read the ARRB's final report and they give an example of a final determination form, but I really hadn't seen any. So I searched specifically like on websites like Mary Farrell, Black Vault is a great website for searching assassination records. Those are probably the two best sites aside from National Archives. Well, they're in some ways better than the National Archives searchable files. But I found a couple of these forms and they turned up and usually they indicated that the files that they related to were already open and full. And so the more I dug, the more interested I got in this. And I found an internal ARRB memo from June of 1997. And the ARRB, I'm not going to say they were in panic mode, but they had an enormous backlog of these final determination forms that they needed to append to each assassination record before they shipped those records off to archives in order to be stored there in the collection. And so the internal memo said, we've got a huge backlog, we need staff to double down, and we need to attach a copy of the ARRB final determination forms to each record that's going into the archives. And if you know, the ARRB processed, I think it's over 4 million records. So that 4 million, each record could be between one page and 200 or 300 pages. So there was millions and millions of pages of documents that went to the archives from the ARRB. This job was enormous. And the fact is, the ARRB did their job. They created final determination forms for every single record, and particularly the records that were postponed from public disclosure. And so I reached out to senior ARRB leaders, and they confirmed, yeah, this was a real project. Yes, we issued these final determination forms for every record. So leading up to the visit, Len, when... last week on Tuesday, I met both Paul Blow and Jeff Crudell in College Park, Maryland. I put in a request to the National Archives for them to advance pull all of the ARRB final determination forms. And really what I was expecting was about, I don't know, 130,000 records in various boxes that included these final determination forms. And when I got there, they rolled out a fairly large cart. It had maybe 15 boxes. They're gray boxes that can contain a couple of accordion files of records. I was told that each box contains about 1,000 pages of assassination records. And, you know, I sat down there on Tuesday and I went through the first 12 boxes and there were no ARRB final determination forms in any of those boxes. And so I was feeling quite dejected because I flew down from Toronto. Paul flew from Quebec City and Jeff flew up from Florida to copy and analyze these forms because they are very important. When I got to the 13th box, I pulled that box out, opened it up, and there was a large accordion file, and it was full of final determination forms. And so I was relieved because at least I had something. And there was another box that had probably another 200 final determination forms in it. So I copied all of those records. If I can just go back and say why these forms are really critical, the ARRB was an independent federal agency, and each of the members of the board were confirmed by Congress after being appointed by President Clinton. It was a very high level, powerful, independent board. They had subpoena power, and they were required again by law to issue final agency orders with respect to each assassination record. And final agency orders are like court orders. So there was essentially something analogous to a court order for every single assassination record. And the key is that the archivist really does have a responsibility to comply with, they have a legal duty to comply with these final orders of the ARRB. And we didn't have a lot of time to actually read each of these final determination forms, but we did look at quite a few of them. And I can say the majority of the records that for these forms that we looked at, and Paul can talk a little bit about this, I would say a majority of them had a release date of 2006, like hundreds of them, required by ARRB order that these assassination records be released in 2006. We searched about, I don't know, what would you say, Paul, about 5 to 10 of these records?
Yes.
And so we found that many of them were released in 2021 or 2023. And correct. Maybe what I'll let Paul do is I'll just let Paul step in and talk. He was responsible for cross-referencing the actual release dates of some of these files.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks, Jeff. So listen, what's a bit, we learned things on the spot because I was actually going down there to be more of an assistant here. The intention was for Andrew to scan as many of these documents as possible, and I would help with the scanner, except that the rules don't allow two people to deal with documents from the same box, so I couldn't do that. But what I could do, so we had to redefine our roles a little bit down there. So I said, well, look, what we want to see quickly, are we seeing orders on these final determination forms that were not followed? And as Andrew was saying, these orders are like a subpoena. You know, you have to comply. It's illegal not to comply with them. So what I would do is either through Mary Farrell or the archives is Andrew would give me a RIF number, which is a file identifier. And I would actually go and get the file that was ordered released, say, for 2006. And I think 5 out of 6 searches on the spot revealed that, hey, these documents were released sometimes 15 years later. They were never released in 2006 the way they should have been. And the order is either postpone or release, but when it says release on such a date, that's an order. So we could see that orders were not being followed. At least that's, I mean, I don't see there, and you can interpret it any other way. What we wanted to do is to see, well, what about the 3,500 files that aren't released yet? Can we find in the ones that Andrew got on some where those orders were not followed? In other words, where Trump or Biden didn't even have the authority to postpone them because the order is already made out by, it should have been released way before it even got to 2017. And we're working on that aspect. But the key thing here is that as I'm looking, you go on Mary Farrell and you get the actual release date. So when you compare the actual release date with the date that it was supposed to release, there seems to be major problems. And if I could throw in something, Andrew, maybe I'll let you go on, you know, and build on this. But the total mess there was, Len, in trying to find a document. In other words, I'll let Andrew explain this, but you could see that even some of the most experienced archivists could not figure out how to find where the final determination forms were. They are, if you search long enough and you know, and you go into boxes that are misidentified, yeah, you can find some identifications, but it's a crapshoot, you know? So I'll let Andrew talk about how that puzzle of trying to weed out documents, it was, I think, for Jeff, myself, and even the archivist, when we would ask him, say, well, why is it labeled this way? The body language and the answers were like, oh, boy. I mean, it was just something else. I'll let Andrew, you know, go from there, because really he deserves the credit for what I assisted on and Jeff assisted on also.
Yeah, Paul, I mean, listen, before I go any further, I got to say the National Archives at College Park, Maryland is a beautiful facility. All the people there were extremely professional. They were, for the most part, very helpful. There are a lot of rules, and I think that's a good thing because we want to protect our historical documents. I just wanted to say that. There were no problems with the professionalism of any of the archivists. They were wonderful to deal with, and a lot of them were extremely helpful. Yes. But what Paul is talking about is really, there should be over 100,000 or more of these final determination forms. These are the most important documents that the ARRB created in their 4 years of existence. And this was their job, to create these final disposition orders. And when I was very specific with my request before going in, that these are all of the documents that I want. I want them for the documents that have been released, but I'm particularly interested in the final determination forms for all of the records that were postponed from public disclosure past 2017, the statutory deadline for release. And I even requested copies of the final identification forms for records currently in the protected or withheld collection. And what I ended up getting really was only 1.5 boxes of these forms. I copied all of them. It amounted to somewhere just under 500 final determination forms. And when I finally got to that 13th box, Len, and I opened it up, I didn't expect anything because the box was labeled press and public contact files, which really has nothing to do with ARRB final determination forms. And the other box, I think, was likewise labeled press and public contact files. And so they had, I don't want to say they misfiled or mislabeled, but certainly you could not search the archives website. You couldn't search any database. These final determination forms don't themselves have any RIF numbers. They're not digitized. They're not cataloged. And you simply cannot find where these records are in order to request them. And I can tell Jeff kind of wants to jump in here.
Yeah, I'll just reemphasize really what you both are saying. But this is really in some ways, it's a very simple thing to get your arms, to get your head around. You know, the ARRB finished their work in the late 90s. At that moment, they gave a roadmap that consisted of a stack of documents, essentially, one for each of the documents in the record collection, giving very specific disposition instructions. This is a group that studied this, highly qualified group of people that held hearings, looked at documents, studied it over a series of years, and then made the determinations of all, each one of those records at the close of their endeavor. And that work was done, and it got handed off to the National Archives. And the ministerial duty was to use the tools, use the work that was already done, simply go through it chronologically and at each moment in time in which a record was either up for release or up for review, using the tickler system that the, you know, ostensibly we understand the ARRB put together as part of their endeavor, to actually go through that process and simply release the record on the date it should be released, or to perform the review as specified in that determination order and document their review and the conclusions that came out of that. If their review resulted in a conclusion to go ahead and release the record, then that should have been documented and the record should have been released. If the review resulted in continued postponement, then the reason for that, the documentation that they performed the review, the reason for that, and then the postponement articulation, all should have been in the records, neatly organized in some way, and communicated periodically under the ministerial duties that the archives undertook as a result of the handoff. And that whole process, at least in the early, and Andrew, if I'm mischaracterizing it, I want you to modify what I say here. But in essence, that set of ministerial duties should have been well documented, and forensically, we should have been able to have seen that in the materials that were presented as a result of what we looked at. And we didn't look at everything. So there's, you know, arguably there's more research to do here and more to review before any definitive answers are made. But what we saw are clear indications that much of the ministerial duty that routinely should have been done as a result of the process that was already in law and mandated and what should have occurred has not. And, shame, I guess, on everybody outside of the government for not holding the archives more accountable in that period from the late 90s all the way up to when the records were supposed to be finally released in total in 2017. But digging into the details of this, I think it's very clear early on that at the very least their documentation of whatever it is that they did is not very good. I was in the healthcare business, and there's a saying. It says if it's not well documented, then it's apparently not been done. And I think that's the question that we have before us today. If there's no documentation in the files, then do we know that the procedures and the ministerial duties that they were required to do were even undertaken?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jeff, I think you've explained that really, really well. And I've got to say this, Len. Everyone who cares about the JFK records as kind of being left scratching their head for 30 years, wondering why these records haven't been released and how the government has kind of gotten away with not releasing these records and these postponements. And these final determination forms, like Jeff just said, they provided a roadmap of orders for each record. And so these final determination forms literally show the why and the how and even perhaps the who failed to release the records. And that's really problematic. And really, if there are still records, and this is the job that we're undertaking right now, we're looking at the 500-some final determination forms. And I believe we found one this morning that appears to still have a postponement in place. So they're still withholding a record that was supposed to be by order released in 2006. And the document was released in 2006. It just wasn't publicly disclosed. And if that's the case, there may be an additional problem because the JFK Records Act explicitly states that once an assassination record is released for public disclosure, it cannot then be reclassified, not by the archivist, not by the agency, and not by the president. So if we find more than this one record that has been, that continues to be marked for withholding and is being postponed from disclosure, that may itself be another violation of the JFK Records Act. It seems like the problems are compounding.
To be clear, Andrew, the document you're referring to was released, but when you find it on Mary Farrell, it still has a redaction. It still has a redaction in it, the one we looked at. So therefore, it wasn't released in full as ordered by the ARB.
Yeah, correct. As far as we can find right now, that document appears to still have one postponement, and that specific postponement was ordered released in 2006, but it still appears to be being withheld.
Andrew, I have a question for you, Paul. So if you go on Mary Farrell, you can find the list of the 3,600 documents or files that have not been released, and you have the RIF numbers. Is it your intention now to ask for the final determination forms of those 3,600 documents?
Paul, I think that's the starting point for the next phase in this research is getting a list of those RIF numbers and making a specific request. First of all, just a simple request doesn't necessarily need to be a FOIA, but I mean, we can do a JFK Records Act and FOIA request to the National Archives to ask for the final determination forms for those record, the 3,600 some records that are still being withheld. And it's my understanding that, look, a lot of those records that are being withheld, particularly the ones withheld in full, are IRS records and deeds of gift, which may never be publicly released because of the way the legislation is structured, but at least for the ones that aren't IRS or deeds of gift or grand jury, like sealed files, we should certainly be entitled to see the final determination forms because the final determination forms were all created to be public facing. They don't have any classified information in them. And they were really the written public reasons for each postponement.
Andrew, I'm going to respectfully bring up a point, because I looked through the description of these non-release documents, and none of them that I've seen so far have anything to do with the IRS, or it's really topics that are, topics that are pertinent to the JFK assassination in the ones I've seen. I haven't looked at all 3,600, but today that's what I did, is I went through the description of those, many of those files, by on Mary Farrell. And it's well done. The only problem we have is that you can't, you'd have to single out every RIF number individually and transfer them to an Excel file or something, so that you can extract them, because that's the way Mary Farrell presents the information. But I think there's an awful lot of documents that, I expect, my suspicion is that there's an awful lot of final determination forms for those 3,600 still hidden documents that may easily have had an order to release. We found and I'll tell you why. It's because we've seen some of them that were supposed to be released in 2006, and were only released 15 years later. So I just don't have confidence that even the files that they're holding on to were just postponed. I think that there were likely some in there that should have been released, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think you can see is that this is still an ongoing research project, and we're at a very early stage, and we're still undertaking analysis of all of these forms. Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to reemphasize what Paul just said. You know, it's 61 years after the assassination, and the reality is that the American public and the world just wants the truth about the case. And the reality is that much of the redacted information has to do with, in some cases, individuals. There's an obvious concern, and there was at the time, and there always will be. You don't want to compromise an individual's safety or the safety of his family or her family. So it's rational in some cases that the information was redacted. But at the end of the day, when there was an explicit decision made with all that taken into consideration to release a record on a certain date, we're at a point where the vast majority of witnesses in this case are, you know, somewhere between 70 and 90 years old if they're still living. It's been 61 years since the actual assassination, and every minute counts. I mean, the clock is ticking, and to the extent that these records may have been useful in determining whether additional investigation was necessary, or perhaps a record might have led to something being done that might not otherwise have been done in that time frame when a person was alive, it really has been a critical faux pas to delay the release of these records. We don't know exactly what impact it may or may not have had, but you can understand with the case in the stage that it's in, how critical it really was to release those records timely. And in fact, many of the records weren't released timely. And sadly, the American public as a whole didn't protest loudly enough to get at them when they weren't making their commitments in the early stages after the ARRB dispersed. So, so there's really, I mean, we can't do anything about that. There's nothing you can do about that. But I do think that it for the historical record, it would be good to know the extent to which the records were inappropriately delayed. And, obviously some indications will come out of the work that, Andrew is doing here, perhaps not exhaustive in nature, but certainly directionally, I think it'll give an indication to the research community to what extent this actually occurred. And it just is one more thing that the American public gets to be suspicious about around the case. Mm-hmm. And perhaps there was no reason at all why this had to happen, but it did.
Yeah, if I may summarize a few things just for your audience now. A, before Andrew did this work, nobody was aware of what a final determination form was. And Andrew did his homework there by talking to people higher ups at the ARB who confirmed their existence and their importance and their significance. They're like court orders. The second thing that we can confirm is that the way these forms are filed, it is made like very difficult, if not impossible, for researchers to know how to find them, get them. There are a few that are, you know, that they did convert digitally, but not many. We know that. And you just don't know because you don't have an index system that tells you such a box has this file. You have to be really lucky to fall on them. The third thing we know is that we found instances of, and probably most of the ones we that Andrew scanned, we will see that there was a breach in the timeliness for declassifying or releasing them, because we're seeing that they say release on such a date, 2006, typically when they are released is something like sometimes 2016, 2020. I mean, we're talking about 10 years late here there. And the final thing is that there seems to be, in those that aren't released, a strong likelihood that some of them, it isn't even under Trump or Biden's authority to not have to push it off. I mean, they should have been released because they were no longer classified. So that, in a nutshell, I think is the significance of these findings. And it may put pressure on releasing a heck of a lot of the unreleased files if we dig a little deeper here.
Yeah, I'm going to jump back in. I think I don't want to get into the details of what happened with the lawsuit and the recent appeal decision. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just issued a decision on Mary Farrell appeal yesterday, and it was not favorable. I don't want to get into that. But what I think that this particular issue with the final determination forms and the potential just blatant ignoring our borders to release the files in conjunction with the Department of Justice's recent move to attempt to assert presidential control over congressional records, which violates both the JFK Records Act, multiple sections, and the basic constitutional principle of separation of powers, that really the key aspect of the status of the files right now is that it needs congressional oversight. Congress needs to step in, A, to protect its own processes and records against executive branch overreach, and two, they need to haul the archivist in to get some answers why there are these orders from the ARRB that were not complied with. And, I mean, those are pretty simple asks for Congress to do. It may seem irrelevant now that, you know, we're 61 years on from the assassination of a sitting U.S. president, but these are answers that still plague Americans and their view of their own government, and they need to be answered. And if the records were improperly withheld from the public, they need to be released.
I think that covers that first phase, so important that we broke in terms of news at Lancer, and that Andrew is, you know, revealing for the first time, I think, to a large audience on your show. But it is, I think, quite important. And I can tell you that the reactions of the people we spoke to at Lancer about this was, you could hear a pin drop, because Andrew was given a special keynote position to speak during the banquet. It wasn't going to be covered. And, you know, the audience had heard, you know, some conferences, speakers throughout the whole day. And it was their second day there. And, you know, sometimes you'd think they might have been a bit tired, but boy, did they soak this in. And they had questions, and you could tell concern. And I think that this is something that will have teeth. And it definitely is new. That's my reaction to the body language, the questions, and everything I saw in, you know.
Well, you didn't really elaborate on the body language. So explain that. What? Were they surprised? Were they upset?
Well, look, I'll give you an example. Robert Groden, I watched him. He was at the table where I was eating, and he, because I went on the stage with Jeff and Andrew, and he was really intently listening. Then there was some person who was taking notes and asking questions on technicalities. People looked upset. They looked upset because, you know, it sounded to them that there was question of unlock. I don't want to say, again, you know, the archivists were fantastic. They were extremely helpful. But at the end of the day, whether it's because of this organization or whatnot, the duties aren't getting done. So the reaction is, Len, I can tell you, we could have gone on, I think, another 20 minutes, and people were soaking it in.
What I meant was archivists. Yeah. What was their body language? I thought you were implying there was something there.
Oh, there. And I think I just remember Andrew asking, you know, the tough questions. And at one point, I brought up, because, you know, Andrew found some final determination documents in a box. But I announced, because by digging and digging and digging online, I found one box that had a file called miscellaneous. And in the miscellaneous, they identified some final determination documents. But I mean, you know, but when I talked to the archives.
Let me just correct, Paul, let me correct you there. Those determination forms in the miscellaneous folder were actually not final determination forms. They were ARB formal determinations, which are a different kind of thing. They are just simply columns of RIF numbers. And there were, and this is the other thing, Len, that we found evidence that the ARRB made determinations on tens of thousands of records, and there are tens of thousands of rows of formal determinations that are proof that these final determination forms exist.
Yes.
Okay. So we can see when the formal determination was made by the ARB at their meetings, and each of those determinations translates into a paper copy of a final determination.
Yeah.
But there were not tens of thousands of final determinations that we were provided access to at NARA.
Yeah.
I was going to make a comment. I mean, first of all, the entire collection is, as Andrew stated, it's massive. In order, anyone, any reasonable person that received these records that were conveyed to them under a ministerial duty to perform what we've described on this show would have to have some form of electronic tracking system. Otherwise, you'd have to have a room full of researchers and scribes constantly looking at records and determining what each one of those determinations said. You can't do it that way. You'd have to have some form of system. The ARRB, as we understand it, understood this issue, and they spent a fair amount of money buying software that would electronically track all of these. We've never seen that. Now, that doesn't mean it's not actively being used by the archive, by the archivists at NARA, but it's absolutely not readily available, if available at all, to the public. And one would think that it would be. It would be a natural thing to have that, or some aspect of that tool, some output from that tool, yeah, readily available, that comprehensively tracks the status of every one of those records in relationship to the requirements of each determination order. And so, you know, there is a question here, I think a larger looming question, and that is, administratively, how are the archivists approaching this? Are they using that, you know, that prescribed approach that was expected to be used? Are they deploying some form of electronic methodology to do it? That's without that, I think it would be very suspect that they could even do it. It's almost physically impossible without some form of tickler system that would allow them to do it efficiently and effectively.
Yeah, you know what, Jeff and Paul were absolutely invaluable in this process, I've got to say. And the thought process that has been put into it by both of these guys contributed greatly to the success, well, albeit a limited success in terms of copying volumes of these records. I think the sample that we do have shows that that there was a breakdown in the system. And the spin-off of this is that I'm definitely going to seek another round of copying and searches at the archives, and I'm going to ask absolutely what Jeff has just indicated. Are there electronic processes? What's the tracking system? Where is it? What's the state of use of the tracking system? There are so many questions that we now have to further our understanding of why this breakdown took place. But really, it's going to come down to some grunt work to cross-reference these final determination forms that we were able to pull out with the records currently in the collection.
Yeah.
I don't know if that gives a good explanation of our visit to archives, but I don't know if you have any follow-up questions.
No, I think I'll leave it for people to email in to press further on just exactly what you hope to find, and the fact that 61 years later, they are hiding documents. You know, they're not in the proper boxes they're supposed to be in, labeled miscellaneous. To me, it just underscores that they want to cover up what really happened, and they don't want the people to know what really happened.
Yeah, that certainly could be one of the outcomes of this. Len, if I can say, we fairly regularly provide updates to the research that Paul and the rest of the authors of the JFK assassination chokeholds are doing. And it's certainly my intent to put together a paper on this with some of the documents, and I took photos while I was there of what I was looking at, so people could kind of experience it like we did. But I'll be updating on our Twitter or X feed at JFK Chokeholds on X or Twitter. And I just got to say, if you don't mind, Jeff Crudell has an absolutely wonderful podcast called JFK, The Enduring Secret, that if you don't mind, maybe Jeff could say a few words about that before we sign off.
Sure. I'd be delighted to. In fact, it was the way that I became acquainted with Andrew several years ago. It's the podcast, which I'm the host and the creator of, is entitled JFK, The Enduring Secret. And it began as a comprehensive tutorial about the JFK assassination. And it's expanded into not only a discussion about the assassination itself, but much of the history and context of the 50s and the 60s that is the underpinning for what actually happened and is really essential for attempting to really comprehend and figure out and digest all the evidence that we present on the show. We're 236 episodes in. We're in our fifth year. It's fairly consistently been in the Apple top 50 documentaries in America. It's been as high as, I think, 10 or 15 in that category. It's got a loyal group of listeners, and one of them was Andrew early on. And that's how we came to connect, and we did a show, excuse me, very early on when the litigation was actually in its early stages on the JFK Records Act. And even for many researchers, I don't think there, at least at that moment, there wasn't very many people in the research community, I think, that really understood the technicalities of that legislation and what it required and what it obligated the government to do. And Andrew took us through that. And it was a spectacular educational moment for not only for me, but I'm sure for many of the listeners on the podcast. And ultimately, we've done other shows too as well. And we the fabulous research that Paul Blow has done has been featured as well on our show. And we're just happy to be associated with such high quality members of the research community. And more of that, as you might expect, occurred this past week in Dallas, where so many of them were able to come together as they normally do on an annual basis and share the most recent findings. And I say that, I use that word findings because each year, excuse me, each year at the presentation, something new is presented. And that's why the release of these documents is so important. It's essential to moving the evidence forward. Excuse me, I got a tickle. But anyway, so I appreciate that, Andrew. I appreciate the ability to say a little bit, Len, about the podcast.
And Paul, if I can put you on the spot, maybe you can tie in just briefly for Len and his audience why the little adventure we had to National Archives ties into the final chapter of Chokeholds.
Well, yeah, okay, sure, thank you. The last chapter is called 61 Years of Obstruction of Justice. And that chapter, I think, is unique in that it carries the reader through just how the Warren Commission and the investigation was a sham. And then how, you know, you went to the HSCA and how George Ioannidis was put in there by the CIA to obstruct justice and to throw off all the investigation. And this, whether it was the Garrison or the ARB, you name it, the amount of destruction of files. You know, we're talking about the importance of files that haven't been released, but try and think if these files are touchy, just how touchy were the files the Secret Service destroyed, or ONI destroyed, or Angleton destroyed? You know, probably they're the most incriminating ones. So Andrew, in that last chapter, wrote an awful lot about how both Trump and Biden broke the law by pushing, you know, declassification beyond 2017. Well, this is the cherry on the sundae, you know. So what you have now is evidence that despite orders to release files, that it wasn't done in a timely manner. So one can be very suspicious when you see released by 2006, and either it isn't released or released only 10 or 12 or 15 years later. So I think it's an amazing continuity to that chapter, what we began discovering in Washington. And that's how important that aspect was. So yeah, I would really suggest that the audience, because we're announcing all sorts of breaking things. There's going to be some big news coming out, we hope, in the next few weeks. And if you go there through our media section or by following us on X, you will see things that are breaking thanks to that type of research. And I would concur that, you know, Black Op Radio and Jeff's show have done an amazing job in keeping people aware of this issue that is one of the most important ones in the American history. I mean, if you look at what happened since that assassination took place and the politics and the polarization and everything that's going on at our neighbors and even, you know, even in our country sometimes because of this, it's important to stay updated on that. So that's, I think, would be nice for your audience to do. And thank you for taking the time. And we're really happy to break this really important news on your show because of your extremely long, dedicated, honest work on this issue.
Yeah, so what you're saying is I haven't given up yet.
No, you're doing a good job, my friend.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time to let people know what your presentation was and some of the new things and where to look for it. And I'll make links to your website. Keep us updated, I guess.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for having us on.
All right.
Thanks, Lynn.
All right. You're very welcome. And we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.